Welcome to the podcast about lighting matters. Our unflinching conversations uncover the nuances and complexities which shape the craft of lighting design.
We explore the pivotal whys behind a lighting designer's choices and find honest answers to your most challenging lighting questions because lighting matters. Welcome to the Lighting Matters podcast. I'm so excited about the conversation we're going to be having today. My name is Lisa Reed. I'm with Reed Burkett Lighting Design in St. Louis. And I'm here with Avi.
Hi, everybody. Avi Moore with More Lights in Chicago. And we have our special guest today, Thomas Patterson with Lux Populi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
And our sponsor today is Us, brought to you by Us, because Us is awesome.
I don't know. Well, I think we need to do endorsements for ourselves now, don't we?
I think we should. Absolutely. Do we need to endorse each other, or I don't know?
Let's do a circle endorsement. Lisa, in your capacity in your last company or your assembled company that has come together over the last few years, I have to tell you that the goodwill going out there is phenomenal. I had a project maybe a decade ago to light some cranes in Miami. It was a feasibility study. Alas, it didn't happen. But they were putting in these giant new cranes, the post-Super Panamax cranes, because, you know, how many superlatives can you add into one name? And they wanted them to be lit to look like flamingos.
Of course.
And these things are vast. I mean, vast. And until you actually stand at the bottom of one, or better, climb up one, you have no idea how big they are and how thin all the elements are. So we were doing a big study, of course. You know, do you trace it with, at the time, neon or LED was an option, but it was equal options, or do you graze it with light, or, you know, all those sorts of things. It's like, who do you call to get advice on that? And I called Randy, and he put me together with a couple of your people. And they said, okay, well, tell us what you're planning. And I talked through everything that I had in mind for how to solve this problem, and how you test it and validate it, and how you deal with things like, it's not painted the right color yet, so how do you deal with reflectance issues? And, you know, you're talking about 2.5-degree beams, so you're talking about really narrow, multi 100,000 lumen luminaires. And yeah, very few people have lit something like the St. Louis Arch or, you know, a piece like that. So, you know, I talked through what I had in mind and we validated what I had in mind. There are some nips and tucks, but I think that's the generosity and warmth of this industry where, you know, someone can help you out with another contract. So, you know, the sort of assembled team that you lead has taken fantastic care of me over the years, and it's greatly appreciated. How's that for an endorsement? Are we bringing it together by Us?
I'm so touched. Yes, I love that, and I can pass that along because Avi recently recommended Us for a project that was outside of the scope of work that his company usually deals in. And I'm just so grateful for that sharing of information, sharing of potential projects and clients. I think it's really important, or maybe not important, it's just really rare to find an industry where we all really do care for each other so much, even though we're competitors. And I've heard outsiders say the same, like they've never seen anything like it. And we all like to think we're special, right?
That's what I tell my kids. We're all special, just like everybody else.
But yeah, I mean, Avi and his team did a fantastic presentation at the IES conference on Dolly, and they have so much expertise in that. I wouldn't touch a Dolly project without talking to More Lights.
Yeah, totally agreed.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, we try. Well, and Thomas, you and I connected on kind of one of the topics that we want to discuss today is just the industry as a whole and, you know, our organization connections and things. But I want to second what Lisa said and Thomas, what you said too, is that the community of lighting designers, I think, is happy when another lighting designer gets the job. Right? I love my local lighting designers. I love my not so local lighting designers who play in our playgrounds, right? And it's all about having good design for the customer, for the client. And if there's a lighting designer, and the way I usually say it is, As long as there's an IALD lighting designer, although that may be changing based on, anyway.
Different topic.
You know, it gets better. And I think, Thomas, you have been very vocal in that. And I love that about where, you know, we have ultimately connected in that change. And we also have chatted a lot about controls and your passion for controls and commissioning and things like that. And I talk a lot about that there are control manufacturers who have dumbed the specification community for their benefit. And there are folks like your team that, you know, have gotten beyond it. Like our team, right? Like Lisa, you mentioned that it's like, it's understanding that's the thing that makes it work and tweaking and making it perfect.
Yeah, I think we're in a situation at the moment where we're going to have to do a lot of rethinking about how the whole controls world and the whole purchasing world is done and how education is done for lighting designers. And I think what you're referring to some extent, and the conversations go way beyond it, is a spat that a group of my friends and I instigated with Lutron, simply because they were using commercial power to force people into, at the time, their ecosystem, system for homes and so on, which was not in the interests of our clients. And our job is to advocate for our clients, not to advocate for manufacturers. And to be able to deal with that, you have to have a wider set of knowledge than what manufacturers are feeding you. And you have to not be buying through manufacturers or their reps and so on. You have to have other ways of putting pressure on the markets. And sometimes it requires, you know, the odd powerful article in the right place to get people on stage to talk about what they need to talk about. And I think as a community, that's one of the things we're not doing enough of, actually. I mean, I think my conversations with you, Avi, are really, you know, worth talking about. I was talking to Stephen Rosen, one of your circle too, just the other day. And, you know, in some ways, my role is not, I'm not the quiet committee person. I appreciate the quiet committee people, the people who make these organizations work. To some extent, my role is the first member in from the SWAT team throwing the flashbang grenade through the window and, you know, letting some other people bring some order to it. But we as an industry, it's nice to be nice, and it's nice that we all like each other. But I think we are, to some extent, being too get along to go along, you know, being positive about things. And we need to be looking at things like controls and supply paths and, you know, markups and roles of reps and distributors in the industry and all this sort of stuff, because at the moment we're not taking enough care of our clients if we're not really pressuring those paths.
Well, and I wonder if there is a part of this also to the unclient, and there is this calling out of bad design, poor design, mistakes with design. As we were getting started today, I was talking to Lisa a little bit about my oldest kid is 5, just started kindergarten. And at the IES conference recently, there was a lot of discussion about flicker and T-LED lamps getting put into classrooms. And I don't have all the research, so I don't want to go the wrong place, but DOE is doing a lot right now on that. And, you know, I'm very sensitive. I don't think I'm as sensitive as Naomi Miller, but, you know, there is stuff coming out about migraines and all this other stuff. And, you know, I just do my simple test. And last night was curriculum night. And if I would have been in that classroom another 10 minutes, my dinner would have been on the floor.
Yeah.
Mm. Totally. And this is kindergarten. I mean, they're going to be in that school for 4 years. Then they're going to go to the next school that's in that district. And, you know, I'm sorry for those listening who may know exactly the district I'm in, but I've offered this district to do things for free. Like, brought an electrician, brought manufacturers. Like, let's do all the first grade classrooms, right? My wife teaches in the district too. And no. Maintenance has got it. We're all over it.
I attended the IES Research Conference this year, which was fantastic. There's some really interesting speakers there. And PNNL let us in. And they showed us their studies on TLEDs. And I'm going to get the statistics wrong, but it was of the order of 24 TLED tubes they'd tested. And I think one passed the flicker test out of all of them. It might have been 2 or 3, but it was, you know, it was de minimis. It was, you know, it was irrelevant. we're seeing that everywhere. We've just started a project. Each of our offices does a pro bono project each year. And this year we're designing a hospital in Kenya. And the total build budget, so the grey construction budget, so meaning concrete and block and so on, is $600,000, the total budget to get this hospital open, excluding the x-ray machine and the CAT scanner, is $1.5 million for 100 and some beds. So, you know, my budget for lighting is going to be challenging, to say the least. And we've said, well, we need to do a minimal number of light sources. They need to be something which can be pre-ordered in quantity with spares, because we don't think we can use TLEDs. Because even amongst the TLEDs that PNNL tested and found good, they'd tested the same manufacturer's panels a year ago, and then this year, the same panel they put back in for testing, and it failed. And I seem to recall that's a capacitor failure. So it's an inevitability that some percentage of capacitors will fail if you've got problematic capacitors. So, you know, on a sample set of one, you shouldn't be getting 100% failure rate. So we're not doing TLEDs in this hospital. And we said, what's our best option? So LED panel, 2x2s, highest lumens per cent, or you know, lowest cost per lumen of any light source on the market. We can get them for under $20 there. And we'll do all the due diligence on the drivers for that, because that's, to your point, that's where the flicker action is. And then we're going to use GU10 MR16s for all the accent lights, which will just be surface-mounted junction boxes with lamp bases. And then in some decoratives, which there are decoratives, we're trying to make a well environment as best we can on the smell of an oily rag, we are going to be using screw-in-A lamps, which we can validate. I mean, that's actually one of the better validated parts of the market, because there are a certain number of reputable manufacturers who are actually testing that, unlike almost everything else. And then finally, we're doing some plug-in night lights, which may even be kitty pattern, you know, little fairies and so on. Because what that lets us do is it lets us have hard wire is only 2x2s. Screw-in is only from one type of box of one type of replacement A lamp. GU10 is only task lighting in medically active areas. And the little plugins only go into the receptacles, where there's a receptacle below the bedhead to be able to do night lighting for kids to be able to get out of bed in hospital and be safe, you know, all those micro little touches that really matter. But the single biggest task, the thing which is going to cost us more hours than the lighting design or anything else, we think is going to be flicker validation on the whole thing. And that's insane. I mean, we've just gone back to 1984.
Right, exactly.
Not in the Orwellian sense, but in that was when that's when T12 ceased to be current technology.
So, I mean, I love that story, and you just taking us through your process there, because there's a perception, or we get accused all the time as lighting designers of gold plating the design, and it's not that. We're just taking care of the things that are important, and even in this project with no budget, you can take care of the key needs for lighting in that space.
Is that true? I mean, I certainly think there are some people who really do focus on all of these things. But I think there's a perception in the market, in our architects and so on, and clients, not without a fair bit of backup, that a lot of designs are not being given the thorough thinking that we need to. Actually, it's one of the things I'm really concerned about in our industry, is that people are racing through, not getting enough training, not getting enough formation, not doing broad enough thinking. And you get all sorts of lighting designers. And to be clear, there's a lot of people out there I really respect. So this is not me trashing everyone. This is more a concern about the general market and where we're at. We're seeing too much lighting design by numbers. Oh, it's a textured wall. We uplight it. You know, the sort of things where there's a formulaic approach, or where there's a decision to do something because it's exciting for the lighting designer to do it rather than because it's what's needed. And, you know, this is not necessarily the independent lighting designers. I'm not going to use the word ILD, lighting designers, for reasons we can discuss later. But it's too many lighting design practices are racing through design too fast and doing design which is not serving their clients' interests or not serving their clients' full interests.
Why is that happening?
Look, I think some of it is financial pressures. I have the luxury of being based here in Mexico City. The cost of rent under one of these chairs that I'm sitting on is substantially less than the cost of rent for people with an office in New York City. So, you know, I'm aware that I have that luxury. I think a huge amount of formation. We practice what we call first principles lighting design, which says that when a project comes in, you look at all the purposes and effects of lighting in the project and all the stakeholders who are going to be affected by it. And then you look at the principles of what light can do for you and see what is possible. an example might be in a retail environment. We did a project which we consider a failure for obvious reasons. I won't name the brand, but a brand came to us who do, you know, $20 to $30 fashion, what they call 4 ounce fashion. You know, the weight of the fabric is pretty minimal. And we worked with a great design practice to do a design for it. And we tried to make it, you know, really glam in the middle. And then around the perimeter, we tried to make it look as much like a Target as possible, you know, decent fluorescent troffers all the way around the perimeter to make all the elevations look well lit and all the merchandise be well lit. But that clue that looks like what Target did so well 10 years ago. And we then sat outside, and once it opened, we sat outside and watched who went in. And it was a bunch of beautifully dressed women going in and looking at the fabric and, you know, touching it and going, it's not my thing, and walking back out. Because the center glamour section was drawing them in. But then when they saw the actual product, it disappointed them. And then the young women who are their target market, which would be upper working class, lower middle class women, you know, typically people in service jobs, receptionists, and so on, as the target market of this client. A lot of them were still going in, but less than we expected. A lot of them were just walking straight past because it looked like it was outside of their budget. And that's a failure of first principles lighting design, right? That's a failure to correctly calibrate to the communication role of lighting. We had done beautiful lighting design. It was gorgeous. But did it serve our clients' interests? Now, the client still thinks it was a success to a large extent, but that's because they were renovating a store which was 20 years old. So anything was going to look better and perform better. Their turnover dramatically increased with the renovation. But the reality is that as a design to then roll out, we actually had to pull it back, reduce the amount of glamour, make more obvious the symbols of being $20 fashion. And this is not disrespecting people who buy $20 fashion. It's respecting them. It's saying, hey, look at the great stuff that's here. And we're telling you this is a place where when you come in, you'll find what you want. You know, it's not patronizing. It's active communication.
Oh, and so right. It's thoughtful.
That's right. And lighting design should be first principles. What's our purpose here? We have a developer we love working with in Australia for whom we've done a tunnel. And they came to us with the original bid request was we would like you to beautify our tunnel. Great. I think that's a good thing to do. I think we should beautify tunnels. We're about to spend round numbers, $20 million on lighting. We should probably maximize the value you get for that $20 million, shouldn't we? So you look at all the other things that are valuable in that project, right? And so safety is an issue. Now, tunnels are incredibly boring spaces. The engineers who design tunnels have a mentality of stripping everything back, reducing risk, reducing complexity, reducing materials, reducing fire hazards, reducing, you know, it's all about simplification. And on a tunnel which you transit in 30 seconds or a minute, that's a really good choice. We had a 9-minute transit. So in 9 minutes, what's the effect of running down a tunnel? And in order to just sort of reinforce with my team how long 9 minutes is, I actually sat with them, and with apologies to those watching the video cast, I actually sat with them for a second and said, this is what I want you to think about. This is what it feels like being in a tunnel, lights going past. Now let's sit here for 9 minutes. How long do you want to experience this? And what we concluded was that as a safety thing, distraction is a bad thing, but raising attention is a good thing. And so we spent all the time not thinking about the aesthetics of the design, but on how we could raise attention levels without raising distraction levels. And if you think about the distraction levels, you know, you're in Chicago at the moment, driving down the Magnificent Mile and seeing all the billboards and all the great storefronts and all these things, and maybe a pretty girl or boy, or in my case, I love dogs and I tend to get distracted by beautiful dogs while I'm driving. All those distractions are happening. So we're capable of dealing with a huge amount of distractions while driving. And that's actually a more visually complex environment too, and a more driving complex environment. People can run across the road, there's traffic lights, there's turning, there's all sorts of things. Whereas in a tunnel, it's perfectly clear. So you do have some capacity to raise attention levels without causing harm. But how do you do it? And you need to then go and study, what are your first principles? What are the things which lead to a raising of attention without distracting? And those are first principle questions that you then take to your client. You say, right, we think we can do something about this. You know, in the retail thing, we think we can signal to the right potential buyers in this store. Are we getting our signals right? In the tunnel, it's what are the things which raise alertness levels and what are the things which raise risk? In other environments, in a food pantry, you know, what are the what's your actual mission in a food pantry? And these dialogues need to happen, but we can see a lot of clients out there who've been trained by other lighting designers, and not by the good ones, but, you know, have been trained by other lighting designers who send us the drawings and come back and say, hey, when do you think you can send us an RCP? Well, most of our lighting is not going to end up in the RCP by, you know, to begin with. Secondly, we won't start a project with you unless you sit down with us for a full day or 2 day charrette. That's a requirement. You must join us for a sit-down charrette. We want to hear you, see you, listen to you. And I'm really concerned about the industry because I think we're treating it too much like a commodity where things come into offices, something gets turned around and pushed out without asking the question, what else can we do? Now, the tunnel work was incredibly receptive, and kudos to the government. The regulatory authorities came into meetings. We had planned two-day meetings, and they left at 11 a.m. on the first day saying, yeah, you're factoring in all the things that we wanted to bring to you. Keep going. And let's work together. And we did thousands of driving passes and driving simulators to test that it would work and that our logic was right. Because I'm a lighting designer. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a roadway engineer. I'm not many of these things. And first principles also says, who do you work with? Who do you talk to? Who do you do all that stuff? So I'm pretty worried about our industry as, you know, we're selling ourselves short on where lighting has impact. We're imagining that light and health, because we hit some lux level stuff for some period of time, is going to make people healthy. But are we actually serving our clients' broader interests?
How do you address the client that comes to you and says, okay, let's do this meeting, let's sit down, but we're going to start construction in 6 weeks?
Well, you really need the meeting then, because if you go off in the wrong direction, you've got no time to get back on path.
Right.
That happens. And sometimes part of the first principles is this is an express project. Anyone who works in retail lives this all the time. You know, we've had projects. We had a house for which there was a party scheduled for 6 months hence, which was attacked by a bear. A bear got in and locked the door behind himself and had a pretty stressful time and did some pretty serious damage. And, you know, the question was, how do we turn around the screening room for this movie event that was coming? And this is for a producer rapidly enough, you know? So yeah, it was how do you get your head down and go? You fly out there, you spend time in the space, you put in quality thinking first, and then you do it right once.
And then I also wonder what happens when those first principles, like a screening you're talking about, then hits the budget and other ideas and everything else comes into play. It's like, yeah, but we still have this date.
Yeah. Look, there's no good answer except professionalism, right? And this is kind of my point. To make that happen, you need to be in constant contact with the interior designers and architects. You know, one of the problems we have with the young designers incoming is they're not accustomed to picking up the phone. Without comments about anyone else's ages on this thing, there's a definition of within Gen X, of which I'm a member, of a group called Golden X. And Golden X, typically now 42 to 48 or something like that. I can't remember the exact number. But basically, we're the ones who, when we were 12 or 14, if we wanted to ask a girl out, we had to call them. Couldn't text them, couldn't email them, couldn't message them, couldn't slide into their DMs. We had to call them. We didn't have to call them. We had to call their home phone.
Right.
And we had to have game to talk to their parents and not embarrass them, because they're not going to say yes to going out with you if it's embarrassing every time you call. And we learned to pick up the phone and deal with, you know, high complexity environments, even just to get, at age 14, hopefully, a kiss. Highly motivated to use phones. We also learned computers from a really raw level. We were dealing with DOS and all these sorts of things.
Right.
But we're young enough to really have adopted, you know, modern technology pretty well. And I think we're in the sweet spot for being able to do the things that the industry calls upon. But I worry about the people ages 20 to 30-something who aren't accustomed to picking up the phone. How many problems get resolved by picking up the phone? How many understandings, you know, to your point, Abby, about, you know, how do you deal with the first part of a project in a rush? Well, pick up the damn phone, call them. Talk through what is it that's important to you. Hey, I'm thinking about this. What do you think about this? You know, if an informal phone call without a screen in front of you actually has the ability not to present material, it allows you to paint word pictures and explain an idea to someone and see if they're on board before you've spent 3 weeks producing visuals. So you're absolutely spot on. But I think there is a solution. I think the solution is in how we form people.
Oh man, I have so many questions running through my head. One, I just want to throw out there, you said something about doing it right once. And one of our designers was grown up being taught, if you don't have time to do it right the first time, you better have time to do it twice. So I love that.
I like that phrase. Yeah, yeah.
But I wanted to ask, how did you get to this this way of designing? Where did you learn first principles design? Where did this come from?
I have like the perfect storm of formation. I mean, you couldn't plan the luck I've had in coming through the industry. I'm a lighting designer because I couldn't dance when I was 10. My primary school was deeply inappropriately doing the Rocky Horror Show for their dance performance.
Nice.
Uh-huh. And I was such a bad dancer that they sent me up the back to run the lighting desk. And it was just a little 24-channel manual preset desk, for those who know what that means.
A little lapping board, probably.
Uh-huh. And, you know, it was manual patching and all that sort of stuff. There's this nest of cables. I remember looking at this 48-way patch and saying, oh my God, if anyone ever unplugs any one of those plugs, no one will ever know how to put it together again. It just seemed totally mystifying to me, and I was fascinated. My parents, with very good judgment, sent me off to youth theatre, and I managed to score not one but two fabulous mentors. Poppy Searle, who you know remains a friend and mentor to this day, looked at me and said, okay, shut up and learn some stuff, you know, really put me to work. The first workshop was a full weekend workshop called Zen and the Art of Optical Perfection, which turned out to be taking all the light fixtures out of the ceiling of the theatre, pulling them apart, cleaning them, and putting them back together again. 6 years later, I was road crew, just unloading the trucks for No Doubt. And as we opened the cases, all the lights were broken. Someone had taken all of the floor stands off all of the lights, put them in the road cases, and as the road cases had been tumbled into the trucks, they'd blown out all of the lenses. By chance, they'd just broken all the clips. They hadn't broken the lenses, fortunately. And I was able to say, okay, let's lay everything out. And I was a 16-year-old kid at the time, you know, but no one else knew what to do. Like, they're all calling distribution houses to see if they can get new kit in. And it's 5 hours before the door opens, you know. And I laid everything out. I'm like, yeah, the only thing that's broken here is clips. There's a lot of screws to be undone and clips to be done, but, you know, it's not a big deal. Sent someone off to get, you know, washers, because that's what you do, replace clips with in an emergency. And then we stripped them out, put them all back together. The last one was literally placed on stage. It was the floor light for Gwen, just as the backbeat was starting on Just a Girl. And everything came up. And that led to an invitation to go and work in the maintenance department. Woohoo! In the maintenance department of one of the biggest rental houses in Australia. So I learned to put together lights. You know, at the same time, in parallel, Poppy thought that my social skills were a little substandard, and she might have been being generous with that. And she said, you're going to manage a stage at the National Folk Festival. She was coordinating the folk festival, so she forced me to be a stage manager. And the next year, she forced me to be a venue manager. And the next year, she asked me to manage all stage managers and venue managers. And so by 16, I was managing big groups. Who gets that good fortune of having a mentor who says, oh, I'm going to work with you on your social skills. I'm going to tell you how to put together a light. And then you get the luck that a whole shipment of lights comes in, broken, just in the way that you can happen to fix.
Yeah.
And then university, I was thinking of getting out of lighting. I was pretty depressed with the whole lifestyle of rock and roll and theater lighting. And I decided to do robotics and artificial intelligence because everything was moving to robotic lights. It seemed like a way out. They're not robotic, by the way. They're just automated. But there you go. And halfway through, I got a bit bored and sitting at a friend's dinner table, mentioned that I'd chosen the wrong degree because I really wanted to do architectural lighting. His dad wanders out of the room, comes back 15 minutes later and says, you start on Monday at Barry Webb & Associates, who are the top lighting design practice in Australia. Turned out 50 years earlier, they chucked javelins in little athletics and had stayed in touch.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
It's just such improbable luck. But that meant that I got a formation in technical, social, engineering, large-scale architecture. And then when I moved to London, I managed to get a job with Isometrics, who are, you know, really the most refined of lifestyle lighting designers in the world, probably. You can't get lucky like that. So the question for us as an industry is not, how do you make more people lucky? Because that's not a rational way of doing things. The question for us as an industry is, how do we create the environments we need where everything that the people have had the good fortune like me, or the people like yourselves who have, you know, whatever path you have to all the skills and knowledge and experience you have, where we're passing it down. I think we're failing to do it. I think we're absolutely failing to do it on a whole lot of bases. I think mentoring is everything, but I think we're missing the fact that mentoring is a skill. There are attitudes behind mentoring, but mentoring is a skill that can be taught. And the better you are at something, the more likely you are to do it, and the more likely you are to do it with enthusiasm, right? As an industry, we're completely disinterested in it. And yeah, I know there's the Silhouette program, and I have mixed feelings about that, but I'm glad that it exists. It's better than not existing. But we need to recognize that the people who have the experience are in their 40s, 30s and 40s, 50s. And the people who are coming into our practices are in their 20s. And they're not accustomed to top-down, boss-led processes. They're looking for relationship-led stuff. Well, that's mentoring. So as an industry, we really have to start thinking about mentoring in a really serious sense. I've started conversations with people in the industry and in our organizations, AES and IALD and beyond, about why don't we make the threshold into professional membership, which happens around the age of 30, when you've got 5 to 10 years of professional experience, that those organizations pay for you to do a 8-day retreat with a bunch of other lighting designers to be taught mentoring skills. Because think about the value of that. Those are the people who are committed to being in the industry. They're bought in. They're also the ones who are ready to build a followership. So their benefit is they get a followership. They get people to deliver their work, to work well with them. And everyone younger than with them has a reason to stay in their practices, to engage with those people, to move things forward. It's not cheap, but it's actually not much different price than what we're spending on American Airlines and Hyatt Place to get a bunch of kids who may or may not stay in the industry age 22 who don't understand what they're seeing to go to conferences across the world.
Well, we don't use Hyatt. We use the most expensive hotels that happen to be in the most expensive places in the country.
Well, there is that.
or not in the country, in Canada or Mexico or anything.
Yeah, that's right.
I was going to go somewhere that might be a bit dangerous, but I'll just, you said something about those of us who are mentoring are in our, what did you say, 40s, maybe 50s? I feel like our industry, this is something Avi and I are doing intentionally, is really bringing shining light on the voices of those who are in their 40s and 50s, because the people I looked up to when I graduated from college are still leading all the conversations. I feel like we Gen Xers haven't taken the reins on that.
I think that's true to some extent. I'm not quite as convinced. I think that's within the core circles of IALD and IES, that's probably true. I think a bit wider. There's a bit more voice. I was in a car on the way to Enlighten with Sean O'Connor, and both of us are counting a few more gray hairs than when we first met back in the day. And we were realizing that when we first met, actually at an IALD jury for the IALD Awards in 2009, I think, that we were dealing with Charles. But Charles Stone, obviously, right. Elvis Charles, he's a mononym. Yeah. We were seeing Charles then at the age we are now. And so you're not wrong. Like, we are now arriving at the age, at the time when these people we think of as being, formative and key, we're at the age we are. And I think putting the spotlight on the people who have the knowledge and experience is really valuable. But there's a key thing the industry has to do is to make those people capable of passing information on well. This is a great conversation. I'm really pleased to have it. But we need to make sure, this conversation is for the people who are already thinking about the things we're thinking about. What the people in their 20s need is the things that they need to be thinking about for today. They need to be thinking about how to engage with clients. They need to be thinking about how to engage with architects, how to negotiate something. How do you win the faith of an architect to be allowed to modify their architecture in order to make the lighting work? Those are skills which we have to teach. And this conversation we're having now is important, but it's not teaching that, and them listening to this podcast isn't going to give them those skills, mm-hmm. Right?
Right. How to have that uncomfortable conversation, as Derek was talking about, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't even have to be an uncomfortable conversation. Sometimes it's just opening the door to understanding what's something about. There's a concept in psychology called the Overton window, and we hear about it in politics, what's acceptable in politics, and we've all seen the Overton window being stretched over the last few years for what is acceptable for a politician to say and not get cancelled and so on. People talk about cancellation, but in fact, the Overton window was much smaller for what was acceptable to say. But the same thing happens in every relationship. What is the acceptable thing? The things that you can talk to your husband or wife about is very different to the things that you would talk to your grandma about, is very different to the thing you talk to someone at the bus stop about, right? That's every relationship has an Overton window. And teaching a kid in the office about how you open the Overton window with your architect about architecture is a big deal. If you want to reshape a ceiling, don't go in on the first minute of the first meeting and say, hey, we think the ceiling form is bad, it won't work, misses opportunities. We really want you to turn it from a barrel vault into a peaked roof. We want to do this, we want to do that. Don't. you want to start opening the Overton window and just expanding your ability, it's like, oh, this would be a great place for a sconce. Ah, we can't do that because the door swing is the wrong way. Yeah, that's going to hit the sconce. Oh, we could change the door swing? Great. Now we're talking about modifying their architecture in service of lighting. The next we talk about, well, you know, this mirror is fantastic here in the bathroom. We could light it like that, but if it didn't go wall to wall, we'd be able to get better side light and you won't have to put those sconces that you're complaining about on the walls. You'll be able to have side light from your mirror. Now we're talking about reshaping the building elevation. And you just keep going through. You expand the Overton window, right? And we all do it intuitively. Like, not everyone geeks out and uses the technical language for it. But these are the soft skills that people in their 40s and 50s have that the people in their 20s need. Where do you teach that? Mentoring, you know?
Right. They learn it by watching you.
And by explaining it. One of the biggest mistakes I made over the last 5 years, and it's cost a huge amount to my office, a huge amount of money, time, and frustration, is that going into the pandemic, I'd spent a lot of time forming a middle in the office, and we got a fabulous middle. They had seen me teach them, but I hadn't explained how I taught them. So they were very good at doing the things, but they didn't yet have the skills to pass what they'd just learned onto the next generation. They'd seen me do it, and they'd picked up some of it. But modeling wasn't enough. You know, modeling being the technical term for getting people to see your behavior and be able to follow it. It needed modeling and explanation. You know, it's one of the key mentoring skills. How do you model something and tell people what you're doing and why you're doing it? You know, when we walk out of a meeting, the standard question gets asked, what did you learn? And it's asked because it's like, it's saying, hey, you didn't just sit there an hour watching me talk. And I can talk. I can wave my arms around. But I don't want people just sitting there vague because I want them thinking, okay, what am I seeing? What's happening? How is this moving? Why did the client agree to that thing which we went into the meeting them saying no to? Why did Thomas completely change the lighting design when he heard what a new fact that the client gave us? Because that's part of first principles, listening and making sure, you know. If you want people to see that and think about it, you have to ask them, what did you learn? The funny thing was, we were driving back for some lighting tests. We were doing some innovative stuff on Dark Sky for a project. We were doing some tests. We borrowed a friend's 14-story building and doing some glare-free lighting off it. And we're driving back, and halfway on the drive, I sort of turned around to the car and said, so what did you learn? And the driver, who's one of our PMs, said, oh, damn it, you got the question in before me.
Ah.
You know, so we've made it part of the culture and we've made it part of the expectation. But if you don't tell people what you're modeling, it's not just people seeing how you do things. That works for the savants. You know, it works for the people who formed our industry who are savants. And Charles is a savant. Howard was a savant. There are lots of these people who see something, learn it, absorb it. Most of us don't have that luxury. Most of us need people to put words on things. That's where mentoring comes in.
So how do we do it?
Man, I wish I knew.
How do we make this happen?
This is a plea for help. I mean,
what's fascinating. I mean, we've chatted a little bit about this, but it hasn't clicked in my head as much as it has at this moment. Because of, I mean, just two things I wrote down that I like can't wait to look up and start instigating instantly in our practice is that Overton window concept, right? Like that happens all the time, right? It's a soft learning of somebody, and I love that. But also, we have a new designer just joined us, and we always struggle with getting new people in, you know, in a small practice, and you know, it's beyond Revit and 3D Studio Max, right? It's learning how we do it, why we do it, why we make these decisions, the process of making the decisions, the troubleshooting. Sorry, I'm going to veer off for a second, but you know, the kindergarten teacher last night was talking about math, and she was talking about how she's going to teach math, but she clicked on something that I instantly translated into troubleshooting education, right?
Yeah, right. Totally.
Like, how do we take these concepts and put them together and make them available to the industry, right? Like, that, what did you learn? Like, shame on me for walking out of this, you know, 2-hour design meeting and not turning to her. And I wanted her to come to the meeting so she saw how the, you know, sausage was made. And then I didn't turn to her and say, so what'd you learn? Like, I mean, it's just kind of just that. That little bit is like freaking brilliant.
It's brilliant. It is.
these are things that I've learned from other people too, to be clear. I can't tell you who that one comes from, but I'm sure I borrowed it from someone. I mean, that's part of the reason I want to have like a formalized mentoring training for people. Like when you teach people to mentor, you also remind them that they have to show how they're mentoring. You know, you have to show how you're doing it and explain it and so on. Because otherwise the next generation doesn't do it.
There are so many mentoring programs, or I think every organization in our industry has tried to create a mentoring program, but nobody has tried to teach people how to do mentorship.
I was going to say, every organization in our industry has scheduled mentoring sessions.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they've actually done a mentoring program.
No.
And, you know, I don't want to speak ill of people who are trying to do the right thing. But just to kind of give you the shape of it, the ask for the mentors in the Silhouette Awards is 1 hour a month for 6 months. But where's the skilling up of the mentors to make them able to do it? And is 1 hour a month an appropriate density? And some of it's been fabulous. They've had some fabulous successes because they've had some fabulous mentors and some really ambitious mentees, and they've made it work. So I don't, like, again, I salute them doing it, but it shows you the model is not about how do we upskill you for the rest of your life.
No, the argument, it's accidental. It's accidental success.
I think even that's a bit, it's lucky success. I think accidental suggests that it wasn't without positivity. But I agree with you. I think if you look at these sorts of things, if you say, well, the industry invests $2,000 each in every member of staff age 30, right? Hypothetical for weeks go away training, and that makes them a better mentor. You get 35 more years out of them until they retire at 65. You know, what did that cost you per year? Because these skills are retained skills. They're not skills that fade, right? I mean, details of it will fade, but the fundamentals of it won't. There's no point in us going to Charles and Barbara and saying, hey, we want to train you to be better mentors. They're end of career. They've done amazing things. They've built a huge number of people. The people who we need to move are the ones who are 30, because that investment stays in the industry for 35 years. It's not the people who are 22. First of all, they don't know lighting yet to teach. And secondly, they're swamped in everything. And thirdly, we don't know if they're going to stay in the industry. It's the 30-year-olds where we need to invest. And it's also hopefully a snowball. I mean, it should be one of these things where those skills get passed on. It's not like they're given once. Give people a big theoretical math education on lighting. They're not going to teach other people the whole theoretical math education. Give them mentoring skills, they will.
Okay, so you're not a quiet committee member. What are next steps here? You've come in and dropped your flashbang. Now what?
Well, first of all, anyone who wants to talk to me from any of the committees, I will happily talk them through this stuff. I would advocate that everyone else in the industry go into their committee meetings and say, hey, what are we doing to upskill? What are we doing to make the mentoring the thing? Because knowledge retention is what this is about. As the mononyms retire, we're losing huge amounts of knowledge that could be passed on. As people our age, you know, find ourselves ever more in admin and doing podcasts, you know, what are we going to be, you know, what time do we have with the young guys in our office to teach them? Those of you who do committee work need to step up and say, you know what, this is where things are going wrong. And the best thing is that if you're doing knowledge retention, it means that all the other things that everyone knows. I mean, it's great that Avi is one of our, you know, industry stars on DALI. That's fantastic. But as an industry, we want to extract that from his brain and spread it as wide as possible, right? From his business point of view, maybe it's an advantage to be the guy. Maybe it's not. But we actually, you know, have a situation on a lounge in an airport where it took 16 weeks to shake out the DALI loops properly because the electricians didn't know what they were doing. And so we've abandoned DALI on the next in the rollout because no one was educating the electricians on the ground. Mentoring skills also apply to being able to see when, oh, okay, I'm specifying this complex thing. I can see that the people at the table are looking a bit blank on this. I'm going to offer to be there for 3 hours and show them how it all plugs together. Yeah, it would have saved me 8 days on site to have given them 3 hours of training. Same set of skills. Now, I feel very sad for every retirement where we haven't gotten the best out of that person who's retiring. You know, I think that's a loss. And that's not to say that a lot of them haven't put a huge amount of effort in. That's not my point at all. But what if we could have had 35 years of them being skilled mentors with all that they know?
Yeah, I the image comes to mind of the tree, right? Where you have that initial point and then you have all these stars that come out of it, right? And it's very common, right? In the architecture world, you know, in Chicago, right? Everybody talks about going to school at IIT, and this connection to IIT brings everybody back. And honestly, the connection to KU architecture too is very connected in the Chicago market as well, which rock chalk all the time. But I don't see that right now in the lighting world, right? You do theatrically, right? The Ken Billingtons. But yeah, there's a piece missing here that I'm so curious how to make it happen. I obviously, you got to continue the conversation. You have to get this out there, which, you know, I'm so excited that we have this platform to do that. And, you know, coming upon us very soon is a place where a lot of lighting designers will be together in San Diego in one of those expensive hotels that you don't get any points for. but maybe there's an opportunity to, stretch this a little bit further and, you know, take on a group. I guess, you know, one of my thinkings with creating this podcast was to have the conversations that just happen in bars and restaurants and record them and make them public, but also to do something that I think some of our organizations should have been doing a long time ago, but they just don't have the time, the finances, whatever. Fine, then we'll do it ourselves.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there is this opportunity, you know, in a few short weeks, quite honestly, I think it's less than a month-ish. Yeah, it's Sukkot. So yeah, it's less than a month to get a group together and find a path to start putting this together, right? And find speakers and find all this. And because it's only going to make all of our businesses and all those people that are coming up more successful. And to your point about Dolly, like I was very conflicted about educating the entire lighting industry on the stupidity they're doing of using anything else. But the reality is we had the conversation and we said, well, if everybody starts doing it, then my life's going to be a heck of a lot easier. So we're going to make everybody's going to be better. And quite honestly, that's the best thing for the industry, right?
Yeah.
Everybody totally gets better.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're not in competition. We've turned away 2.5 years of work in the last 4 months. So, you know, they're still slopping around there. Plenty of work in the industry.
Send them to me. Send them to me.
Alas, not your market, I'm afraid. They don't want Dolly.
Right, yeah, there's the problem.
Jokes aside. The ability to put together something like this is actually harder than you'd think. For Enlighten, I have to say, I got approached by a manufacturer who asked, you know, what could we do, you know, about this topic of mentoring? You know, what do you need? And, you know, told them what we needed. And then they said, oh, great. Can you do it in 45 minutes? Which is not terribly helpful. You know, you're not going to get substance in 45 minutes. You've got to get people on board for what you want. So look, I think the first place to tackle it, you know, if you want to call to arms for things that could happen pretty immediately, it's actually the people who own businesses or lead businesses who can choose to invest in bringing outside help. They can, you know, we have an organizational psych who comes in and works with us every 2 years, and we do 14 to 3 hour sessions, and then we do a week's retreat, and we deal with communication skills, we deal with relationships, we deal with managing emotions, and all those sorts of things. And that's one side of things. Internally, because we're very conscious of these topics, we spend more time talking about them, and, you know, setting up the culture of what did you learn and all of those sorts of things. But I think it's the business owners who have the power in the industry to move things. You know, I'd love it if the organizations would do something. They're blanking.
But Thomas, you're talking about things that you're doing. Do you have like a list of resources that could ultimately be shared? Like, I would be really interested to start that inside of More Lights, but I need a place to start too.
Yeah, so the organizational psych thing, no, I don't have a list of resources, and for a really simple reason. It tends to be you need to find someone who's simpatico with what your business is about and what you're doing. So it's research. It's reaching out and finding out who's out there. You're not looking for someone who's selling you a package. You're looking for someone who can hear what you're about. Lighting is such an odd duck industry. You know, we are odd ducks. Our clients are odd ducks. Our processes are, you know, odd little paddling ponds to play in, you know. We're an odd duck industry. So you're not going to get someone who's used to training, has programs for 30,000 employees of General Motors who can then come and apply that to a lighting design practice is not appropriate. So you have to go local, you have to go personal, you have to find the organizational psych if you're going to do it that way. In terms of skills, I think we need to have people writing books about this stuff and making that stuff accessible. I think we need to have people who open up workshops. I mean, you think about the fabulous Jan Moyer landscape workshops where they're longer and more hands-on. People who have these skills maybe need to be doing this stuff. Now, Avi, I suspect you're going to say, "Well, so when are you doing one?" I can see that question brewing. And alas, you know, like so many business owners, I have a complex life. I have children a little older than yours, but not much, with their own complex needs. I have 27 designers sitting around me who I have to form. I have 70 live projects, all of whom, you know, the clients need attention. Where do we get this? I think we have to outsource. I think we have to read and listen with interest. I think we have to listen endlessly to podcasts. You know, there are endless fabulous ones, like Hidden Brain, which really spend time thinking about relationships and how you move relationships and so on. And I think we could put together a bit of a notes page for this where we can pull those things. But I think that's where we start, you know. But in reality, it's a call to arms for the committee members to, you know, follow the flashbang.
You should speak on this topic, at least. I mean, do the 45 minutes and do it as a call to arms. And then someone will take it up. Because you know what, Thomas, I did that Wild came to be as a result of me speaking at an Enlightened conference and saying, "Hey, we need something for women in this industry." And I don't want to be the one to do it. I don't have time to do it, but somebody needs to do something.
It's interesting. Wild, I actually reached out to Wild and offered when they were setting up some mentoring stuff to do some training on that stuff. And I got no response.
Really?
I've always wondered whether I came...
I was thinking about Wild when you were talking.
I was wondering whether I came across as mansplaining.
I'll find out.
I hope it wasn't, but I didn't have the capacity to be a mentor over a long period of time at the time. So I said, I could do some intensive time on this, and I would wish them well if they reached out. There's no resentment in that, but it's one of those things. It's very hard for people to say, you know, this is what we want to focus on. So if there are some people advocating behind me, I will make the time. Unfortunately, I won't be at Enlighten this year. Complex kids.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we have to go around and do a circle of endorsements amongst us all again, don't we? This podcast has been brought to you by the fabulous people at More Lights, RBL Lee.
and Lux Popular.
Exactly.
Well, I think this is great. Man, there's so much more to chat about. But I think I have so many notes to follow up on from this conversation. And I hope the audience really takes it to heart and reaches out to Thomas and those committee members, those people who have the extra time other than what Thomas and I and Lisa have to take on some of these things. I know I, for one, would be happy to assist, but again, can't commit the time, right? That's the hard part of where my family is, where my business is. But this is so important. And I really appreciate the conversation. I appreciate you taking the time to share it with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much for creating this forum for us all.
I do hope that this is the start of, you know, this is the match, lighting the flame that makes something happen.
Agreed.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Lighting matters. As we wrap up, we want to reiterate how much we value your time. And we hope you found it as much fun to listen to as we had creating it. Remember to like it and share this content with your friends and colleagues.
The opinions expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official positions of the sponsors. Our content has general application, but we recommend obtaining personalized guidance from a professional IALD lighting designer, such as RBLD or More Lights, for your next endeavor.